Workers were looking for new tenants, and they found them in a clutch of Navy men who'd been involved in wartime code-breaking activities. Now America had a new enemy, the Soviet Union, with new codes to crack. And the company these Navy men created was dubbed Engineering Research Associates.
Have you ever taken a lie detector test before?
In no time, ERA was siphoning off graduates from the University of Minnesota's electrical engineering program to work in shirt sleeves and tie on top-secret code-breaking machines. In the 1950s, the ERA team built an early programmable computer that could simply be reprogrammed when codes changed. Operations continued at Minnehaha Avenue until 1991, when the lease was dropped and the facility once again became just another property for rent.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Programming is supported by Minnesota Opera, presenting The Snowy Day, running February 8th through 16th at the Ordway in downtown St. Paul. The Snowy Day is an opera based on the award-winning children's book by Ezra Jack Keats, bringing center stage the fleeting but indelible magic of childhood. Tickets at mnopera.org.
From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. Today, we're honored to welcome Mary Jane Oatman, a leading advocate for tribal sovereignty and economic empowerment. Mary is the executive director of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association, where she champions Native leadership in the cannabis industry. Proud member of the Nez Perce tribe, she's dedicated to integrating traditional knowledge with modern opportunities, ensuring Indigenous voices are the forefront of this rapidly growing sector. Join us as we explore her journey, the challenges and the opportunities for Native communities, and her vision for the future.
From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Gary Wilcox, and joining me today is Larry Kay. How you doing, Larry?
I'm doing well over here in Florida. How you doing, Gary?
All right, we're just chilling out.
Right on. Today we welcome Mary Jane Oatman. She comes to us from Kaymaya, Idaho. She is the executive director for the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. How you doing, Mary?
I'm doing great. Excited to join you guys.
Hey, Mary, welcome to the show.
Yes.
Thanks for having.
It's been a while since our last visit. A few years. It's good to see you again.
Oh yeah, I've been doing a lot since then, and most of it in the hot topic world of hemp and cannabis.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm happy to have you on the show today and give us an update on the cannabis industry in Indian country. So why don't we start by telling us a little bit about the history of the ICIA and then your role as executive director.
The Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association is the nation's first trade association working to bring education, advocacy, and empowerment to Indian country in the hemp cannabis industries. It was founded in 2022 by a group of very progressive leadership in the state of Wisconsin. Our founder is Rob Perrow, and he's a member of the Bad River Tribe. And he rallied together a board that saw a vision to make sure that our voice was heard loud and clear in our nation's capital when it came to ending the negative stigma in plant medicine for hemp and cannabis.
Nice, nice.
How does the ICIA support tribal nations and Indigenous entrepreneurs in the cannabis industry?
Well, what we're really missing, not just for Indian country, but as a whole, is because of that long tenure of prohibition, is data, you know, for our leaders to be able to make informed decisions at, you know, the congressional level, clear down into our local municipal levels and our tribal leadership. So research and data are pivotal for the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. to collect and coalesce what's out there so that we can make more informed decisions moving forward, but also to make sure that as we move forward, that our communities are represented in the formulation of that research. Because if it's not including our communities, then it really is quite irrelevant to our mm-hmm. communities if we're not yeah. a part of the norm reference for the data sets of these research projects for cannabis.
Nice. Okay.
I was thinking, there's a lot of challenges out there. What challenges do we face, Indigenous communities, in entering and thriving in the cannabis industry?
The biggest challenge, and one of the reasons, I guess it's twofold. One is that there are organized efforts out there, just like we saw in the gaming industry, right. organized efforts to make sure that Indigenous communities and tribal sovereignty is an afterthought in any reform, that we just get scraps.
Right. Yeah.
That are laying underneath the table. Yeah. But what we've done with the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association is built a whole new table, and we're inviting people to come to our table mm-hmm. to integrate policy reform around the tenets of upholding tribal sovereignty and self-determination. Mm-hmm. And I think another one of those really important parts is that those same vultures
right.
are out there looking to do nefarious things within our tribal communities because sure. they are mm-hmm. so ripe and uninformed. And this is still federally illegal. So there's a lot of secrecy mm-hmm. in what happens. And so as an organization, we're pulling tribal communities together. We're talking, we're sharing the good, the bad, and the ugly of what's happening in our communities. And with that, it's kind of flushing out some of those bad actors, or at least shining a big bright spotlight on them so they can't do it to the next community.
Mm-hmm. You spoke on tribal sovereignty, and I just wanted to touch on that. How does cannabis legalization interact with tribal sovereignty, and what opportunities or risks does it present to the Native Nations?
Well, that creates the opportunity for each tribe across the nation to determine how they take what has historically been just criminal prohibitions from cannabis and use self-determination and sovereignty. Determine if they integrate that into, a civil penalty. And then from there, do they transform that into business codes and look right. at setting up business enterprises? Some tribes are just maintaining a cannabis, I guess you could say their progression is more towards just civil penalties or just simple things like let's decriminalize, let's stop terminating people and firing them and creating that situation of a sense of fear around job security. Mm-hmm. Other tribes are making sure that this is not about the green rush in cannabis and a purely economic approach. And they're looking at it from integrating their health systems around it for medicinal and clinical research. And so that's really where we're at as an organization, is kind of like looking at what are these codes, ordinances, and models that these tribal nations are embracing mm-hmm. under the tenets of tribal sovereignty, and finding out what are kind of some of those best practices that are emerging from the legalization. But what we're noticing, the shift and evolving changes from tribes waiting for a state to legalize.
Right.
And then after a state legalizes, and then they pursue that economic activity within their homelands. The biggest example of that is the Eastern Band of Cherokee in North Carolina, first tribe in the nation to preemptively move ahead of a state for medicinal as well as adult use cannabis. And that's where we're seeing some of the economics come out, is where these tribes are leading in states where there's no other economic viable markets in those areas. Minnesota, another great example, where mm-hmm. we've got the Prairie Island, the Red Lake Band, and the White Earth. They're all moving forward very progressively, right. and that those tribes have a market monopoly there for quite some time.
Now, what about the policy changes, when it comes to federal and state? I know we got to wait for federal to make the big move.
That's also where we're seeing the interesting dynamics. We have the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act in mm-hmm. gaming, where tribes have compact provisions to be able to enter into gaming within those states. Sure. Early in cannabis, we saw that as a practice within Washington tribes. And then as cannabis moved from the West to the East Coast, we kind of started to see that shift change. And right. I can completely understand that in a state like New York, where the government-to-government relationship is not like it is in Washington, mm-hmm. which is why as a trade association, we have to also be very mindful that it is not a one-size-fits-all mm-hmm. when it comes to cannabis and hemp in Indian country.
Now, how can the cannabis industry serve as a tool for economic development and self-determination in the indigenous communities? By these pop-ups that come out, or the storefronts?
I love that question, actually. And what we're seeing is in jobs. It is in finding another opportunity to create revenue sources within the community for folks that may not fit into the banking industry or the logging or milling or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, even fishing economies, whatever the regional or local economy is. And in some circumstances, the cannabis was that opportunity to keep the community afloat during COVID. So some of these communities that had already diversified their portfolios outside of the gaming industry, cannabis was deemed essential in most states during COVID. And so it was the revenue economy that was able to hold over budgets, employed. And I see that for career ladder and workforce development within our tribal college and university systems, this is a whole nother area that is yet to emerge, accreditation of these science-based nice. Programs in tribal communities.
What are some ways indigenous values and traditions influence approaches to cannabis cultivation and use?
I've seen some great examples of this. You know, one of those is just the ethos of indigenous peoples that embraces this concept that our relatives are all around us,
right.
and that we have lessons to be learned from them. You know, that we don't just know everything, that the plants teach us lessons as well. And so plants as teachers, I think, is one of those areas that our tribal communities, that's something that we're spreading outwards into the non-native communities that are kind of just seeing this as profit and commodity mm-hmm. and don't really look at the spiritual practices that come to play with sacrament. And I think that even just that word alone of sacrament, that is very unique to our indigenous communities. But we have to be mindful of that, because not all communities are in the same place with that conversation. I speak to that from my own specific community in regards to the Nez Perce people, the Nimiipuu people, and the town that I actually come from, Kamiai. Kamu is the word for our Indian hemp rope. And it was well documented during the Lewis and Clark expedition. Not only the rope culture and the hemp along the Lewis and Clark trails and the different tribes that had relationships with the textile and the fiber, but also very well documented since Nina Pinta and the Santa Maria landed here, that there were many indigenous communities that had smoking sacramental cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of those areas where we have to re-embrace that and meet our communities where they're at with that conversation, but also holding that line for those that are not ready yet there mm-hmm. At the federal level to make sure that there is no disruption in the programs and the access to quality medicinal cannabis and other medicines that our tribal communities have been able to create that access for. And I see others is in psychedelics. There are other tribal communities working in psychedelic therapies, that when anything happens at the federal level, that our communities don't see an erosion.
How does the ICIA educate and raise awareness about the benefits and challenges of cannabis in our native communities?
We started hosting a policy summit in Washington, D.C. the very first year that we were formed. So in June of 2022, I accepted the position to serve as executive director. And in November of that year, we hosted our first national policy summit in Washington, D.C., filled a stage of experts. And during that first year, it was really important for us to just start to collect data and that direction. And then we started hosting some regional opportunities, but also it was really imperative for us to just lean into our existing sister organizations. So taking the opportunity to do an assessment of the National Congress of American Indians, the Native American Finance Officers Association, our housing organizations, National Indian Health Board, kind of get a pulse check of where they were at with cannabis policy. Did they have existing resolutions on record for or against cannabis policy use, either in the workplace or as an organization? And then just introduce ourselves as an organization to serve as that resource, because most of them don't want to leave without conversation, or their membership has not moved forward with it being a policy priority necessarily within their agendas. And so we come in with education. So we have been working for the past 3 years with NCAI leadership and staff to make sure that we have cannabis policy updates. This was our first year getting on their general assembly as a nonprofit organization to give kind of a state of the cannabis national overview. And really that's what we do, is like stand ready to be a resource with partner organizations. And we do require tribes to sign a resolution to join as a member of our organization, but their tribal enterprises do not. So we're also finding that tribes, the very first tribe to join the ICIA was the Secaucus Mole Lake in Wisconsin. And we're going to be returning there on February 27th for our third annual Wisconsin Policy Summit. So it's really, we want the tribes to take the lead as much as possible with this conversation. So as many convenings and networking opportunities that we can get them together, roundtables, monthly tribal roundtables, tribal leaders task force, and through our leadership efforts out of Montana, hopefully the early development of a regulators roundtable, which will kind of be that early infrastructure. I mean, tribes know cash handling, they know highly regulated industries. And so our message, you know, to the folks in Washington, D.C. is we've got this.
Right.
The interference, you know, arm's length approach, if you know what I mean, for our tribal communities.
Absolutely.
Today, our guest is Mary Jane Oatman, Executive Director of the Indigenous Cannabis Industry Association. You can visit them on the web at indigenouscannabis.org. There, you can find out how you can become a part of the movement.
tell us about some success stories that the ICIA's work has had, and one of them that's maybe particularly proud of, that you may be particularly proud of.
I'm proud of so many of the things that are going on, but the one for me, because as a trade association, we've really fallen into having conversations about what we can't do.
Yep.
But there are tribes out there that have been very progressive in the industrial fiber under the USDA hemp programs. And so the Lower Sioux Indian community in Morton, Minnesota, they are going to be the hosts of the International Hemp Conference this year in October. And their site was selected because not only are they doing something progressive for Indian country, they are game changers and innovators for the entire globe with what they're doing in building hemp homes in Indian country and solving those problems. It's very, very much a need for all of Indian country, but they started growing hemp. And because they had not yet had a processing center and they weren't developing their own certified herd for the program, they just started ordering it in, and they're really working on that that cost nexus with the hemp industry to get it to affordability. But they had to start with an import model where they were shipping in all of the hemp lime, the herd, and of course, that's just the three components that you need: the herd, the lime, and the water is a composite mix to be able to make this very innovative building material that is fire resistant, mold resistant, and road resistant.
I saw that. I saw that on TV. I saw that. That's neat.
My favorite. I had the opportunity, I was actually visiting and doing tour at the White Earth and the Red Lake facilities. And so I drove all the way from Idaho out there. Nice. And that was very, very purposeful as well, because I had it all mapped out. I was going to go up and check out those facilities. They had just opened that year, drive back down through and see Lower Sioux Indian community's first home, where Danny DeJarlay, their hemp builder, was working with Joey Goodthunder on their farm side. And their chairman, Deuce Larson, was just recently elected in, that same week. And he was able to go on a tour with us to the White Earth facility. And just this year, they opened up their first dispensary at the Lower Sioux Indian community. So just to see that when you give proper education, fact-based education to tribal leadership, you surround them with that safety network of other trusted tribal leaders that are doing this activity, network the, you know, the attorneys and the legal professionals, that they can move forward with confidence and knowing that there's going to be that network. And we've had that actually happen on a couple of different occasions where a tribal community was felt under attack, or, you know, their program was in jeopardy, and that we rallied the supports of our network to stand beside them. And I think that that's what is going to be powerful moving forward with what has been built with the ICIA is unity in the cannabis and hemp community.
Nice. Mary, what events does the ICIA have planned for us this year, and how can we help?
We have some great events just right around the corner. Mm-hmm. February 27th, we're going to be at the Secaucus Chippewa Mole Lake facility, their casino, for our third annual Wisconsin Cannabis Industry and Policy Summit. And then we're going to be shifting gears into a fun golf tournament fundraiser on the Nez Perce Reservation here in my homelands. And we're going to be hosting that at the Red Wolf Golf Club, which is owned and operated by my tribe. We're already partnering with a national charity golf company to be able to get some like celebrity golfers. And we have some fun after hours fun planned as well, where we're going to have Indian country celebrity Dogface as one of our performers and other Indian country music performers. So that is going to be May 1st. We're going to be hosting a tribal leaders roundtable, and then May 2nd is going to be the golf tournament. Of course, we'll be seeing everybody this year during Reservation Economics Summit. ICIA will be down there for some hemp and cannabis education into those forums. Also have a trade show floor booth, so be on the lookout on our social media, and we'll give shout outs to where you can find us in the on the trade show at Res.
Yes.
And then we all will continue to host our Washington DC Policy Summit during Native American Heritage Month in November. We already have our save the dates out there for November 12th, 13th, and 14th of 2025. And in between, we're going to be all over the place.
Right,
NCAI, Indian Gaming, NAFOA, we will be there. Plus, one event that's super special for us is 3 years ago, we started partnering with a 420 Unity Coalition. And so every year, the ICIA does a member fly-in to Washington, D.C. in April during 420 week, and partner with the National Cannabis Festival Planning Partners, Last Prisoner Project. And we go in and do an intensive advocacy where 30 Unity organizations carry each other's policies to the Hill. Last year, I was able to do a press conference and speak on behalf of protecting tribal sovereignty in front of the Capitol. Mm. So we really look to increasing. Last year, we had about 10 tribal folks from across the country, including one of our leaders out of Wisconsin, Michael DeCora. He drove all the way from Wisconsin to Washington, D.C., and him and, very small but mighty delegation had a very high impact, no pun intended.
Awesome. So what is your vision for the future of Indigenous participation in the cannabis industry? Tell us about your vision.
My vision and goal was to have 100 tribes as members of the ICIA by the end of 2025. And for me, we need money as an organization to raise
yeah, but of course.
The challenge of getting that resolution across the table. And so 100 tribes and 100 tribal entrepreneurs. Yes. I really love being able to connect the network and network the businesses that are on the ground. And even from my own experiences, it's usually that tribal member, those tribal entrepreneurs. My grandparents went to federal prison for cultivating cannabis on the Nez Perce Reservation.
What?
So. I grew up a legacy baby, if you will. And so it was natural for me to come out of my cannabis closet, as a past appointee under the Obama administration. And a lot of folks knew me across Indian country for the work that I had done in education policy. And I felt like it was very similar. We need education advocacy, the empowerment in Indian country. And everybody knew my name was Mary Jane. I didn't have to. I go out into the mainstream world, and most people, that's the most frequently asked question that I get besides seeds and samples is your name really Mary Jane? Because that's what people do in the cannabis industry.
Yeah, I got a song named after me too.
Right.
But
on.
There is really actually a lot of a cultural appropriation that happens in the cannabis industry because of that. Affinity to our communities and smoking. So you'll see the chief in, or you'll see the medicine man or the shaman. You see a lot of that in the branding and imagery across the cannabis industry. So I think that for me, that's just affirmation that the mainstream cannabis industry recognizes that we have and have always been in this place.
Mm-hmm. Salute. Well, Mary, thank you for visiting us. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show today.
It's been an honor, and if anybody wants to learn more, they can check us out at www.indigenouscannabis.org and learn how they can become a friend of ICIA, get our newsletter, and join the movement.
Right on. Will do.
Mary, it was a pleasure having you with us today. I learned a ton, and I just want to thank you. It was great. Thank you. I am so happy that you came on the show today.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. Larry K. It's an honor.
Yes. Have a good day. I'll see you over there at the Gaming Association.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. And Res Biz. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our assistant producer is Paul Salvatore.